If you have a copy of the scriptures with you this morning, let me invite you to turn to Genesis 31. That's where we will be. Last week, we're sort of in the middle of a story. It was a natural breaking place, but last week we saw Jacob offer to serve Laban, and if you remember, he offered to serve him for a pittance, really, or at least potentially. You see, by taking those spotted and mottled sheep, they're the oddball sheep. To speak in modern parlance, they are the recessive sheep. And so there's going to be fewer of them. And so Jacob has put himself into a position where for him to succeed, for him to prosper, even to succeed as well as a hired hand shepherd, much more so to prosper as God has told him he would prosper, he's placed it squarely in God's hands. Even without Laban stealing his starter flock, it would have taken a miracle for Jacob to succeed under these terms. And yet Laban did cheat him, you know. God has brought Laban into Jacob's life for this very purpose, to test him and to try him and to form him into the man that God has called him to be by being his enemy. The cheat needed to learn not to cheat. The conniver needed to learn to trust God instead of leaning on his own wisdom. And even though Laban got incredibly favorable terms here, he steals from Jacob anyway. He took the striped and the mottled and the black ones and he put them 3 days away from the flock that Jacob was keeping so that Jacob got nothing. To borrow from Jesus' parable, when Jacob entered into this agreement, taking those recessive sheep, he took, if I borrow from Jesus' parable, what Jacob was doing was he was taking the lowest seat at the banquet table, insisting that if he's going to be lifted, it's the master of the banquet who will promote him. You understand what he's doing there? So we see a changed man before us in our narrative. This is not the Jacob that we met at first. In entering into that deal, he had ensured that his integrity wouldn't be called into question. He knows he's naturally a cheat, and he knows that he's dealing with a cheat who's attuned to being cheated. So he picks a plan that's going to guard his integrity, but it's also a plan that puts the ball squarely in God's court. So this is not the Jacob we first met. Let's see how the story continues. We're in Genesis 31. It's 55 verses, but we're gonna take it in a few chunks, okay? First three verses. Now Jacob heard that the sons of Laban were saying, Jacob has taken all that was our father's. And from what was our father's, he has gained all this wealth. And Jacob saw that Laban did not regard him with favor as before. And then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your kindred, and I will be with you. So Laban, I hope you can appreciate this, Laban has actually set himself against God. God blessed Jacob. God turned his face toward Jacob. God was with Jacob. But Laban has turned his face away. See, Jacob's sons had noticed that all of the property that they had became their father's. And so they're sitting there watching their inheritance dwindle. While they're watching cousin Jacob, who's supposed to be the hired hand, he is getting rich. So they see that, and from their vantage point, Jacob all owes everything he has, all their success, they owe it to their dad, Laban. And Jacob gets wind of this, but not only that, If I can woodenly translate the idiom here, it says, Jacob saw the face of Laban, and behold, it was not with him as it was yesterday or the day before. So God is with him. God has lifted up his countenance upon Jacob, but Laban has turned his countenance away from Jacob. Now the Lord gives a command, go home. It's the very thing God promised that he would do for Jacob when he left, the night he left town. You remember that? He was running from Esau. Esau was angry with him, was murderously angry with him. He was running away, also toward a wife. He was running from Esau toward a wife. And the night that he's going to leave the promised land, the land of his inheritance, into exile, God appeared to him in a dream. It was that dream with the ladder and the angels going up and down. You remember that dream? Well, in that dream, God had promised to be with him throughout his exile. And he had promised to bring him back to this land. So Jacob's now got the command to go. He's now going to go back. He has to get his wives on board. It's not like he can go without them. It's not like they are slaves either. Laban's going to treat them as slaves, but not Jacob. And his task is a tall order. He's got to get these two women. You remember their history, right? With the War of the Wombs. He's got to get these two women to agree. But this is a matter requiring some privacy, and so he calls them out into the field, not just to give privacy, but also he calls them out into the field to give them a visual display of the case that he's going to make. Verse 4, so Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah into the field where his flock was, and he said to them, I see that your father does not regard me with favor as he did before, but the God of my father has been with me. You know that I have served your father with all my strength, and yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times. But God did not permit him to harm me. If he said, the spotted shall be your wages, then all the flock bore spotted. If he said, the striped shall be your wages, then all the flock bore striped. Thus God has taken away the livestock of your father and has given them to me. In the breeding season of the flock, I lifted my eyes and I saw in a dream that the goats that mated with the flock were striped, spotted, and mottled. And then the angel of God said to me in the dream, Jacob, and I said, here I am. He said, lift up your eyes and see. All the goats that mate with the flock are striped, spotted, and mottled, for I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and made a vow to me. Now arise, go out from this land, and return to the land of your kindred. Then Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, is there any portion or inheritance left to us in our father's house? Are we not regarded by him as foreigners? For he has sold us, and he has indeed devoured our money. All the wealth that God has taken away from our father belongs to us and to our children. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do. So Jacob... his approach to his wife is, your dad doesn't like me anymore, but God is with me. I have done my best for your dad, working as hard as I could, but he keeps changing how I get rewarded. If I'm getting ahead, he cuts my legs out from under me. He's trying to defraud me out of everything. But God wouldn't let him. God thwarted his conniving at every turn and worked evil on his own head. And in verse 10, he lets his wives in on a vision that God had given him. God had shown him in a dream how the flock spontaneously suited the wages that he was being given. Because God is the God who sees. How many times has that been the testimony of faith for believers? Hagar at the well, Be'er Lahai Roy, the well of the God who sees me. Or Reuben, God has seen my affliction. Behold, a son. Well, God assured Jacob that he sees what Laban is doing to him and is active to thwart it. And in that dream, God pointed back to his earlier encounter when he was leaving town that night and had that dream with the ladder. So he dreams about a dream, which is mind-boggling. But in the second dream, God refers to that first dream at Bethel, where God had promised to be with him while he was in exile. And with that reminder, he'd been given instructions. Now arise, go out from this land and return to the land of your kindred. So that's his case to his wives. Now notice how Leah and Rachel respond. By the way, I think it's odd that Rachel is named first here, but I don't know what to say about that other than, yeah, I agree, that's odd. But Rachel and Leah look around and they ask questions. Now, they're not real questions. These are rhetorical questions. Is there any portion or inheritance left to us in our father's house? Well, no, not really. That's been diminishing. He doesn't have a whole lot left. And what he does have would go to his sons. We know that Laban has sons. So, are we not regarded by him as foreigners? Now, that's a little strange, isn't it? Except that they go on to explain it with the next question they ask. Has he not sold us? You know, as we went through the events of those weddings, we focused on Laban's deceit. We focused maybe a little on Leah's participation, certainly on Jacob's disdain for Leah. But now we're treated to the girl's perspective on those proceedings. What the girls had hoped for was a dowry, a bunch of jewels and gold or something from their home that was theirs to bring into their marriage. Ordinarily, the father of a bride would give to the bride a dowry to bring into their wedding. It's a bit of seed for future wealth, to get the couple on their feet. We do similar sorts of things today. But wait a minute. Now, what about the bride price? Isn't that selling your daughter? Well, no. You know, when there was a bride price, here's how it would work. Or work back then, anyway. So I'm a young man, and I've got my eye on this veritable princess named Cheryl. And so I go to her dad, and I say, I'd like to marry your daughter. Well, there's going to be a whole series of questions. Mr. Lindsay was quite the man of God. So he would ask me, you know, am I a believer? Tell me about your faith. Where do you go to church? Tell me about your church life. How's the Lord working in your life today? But eventually, he's going to get to, can you support my daughter? And he's going to want to know what I do. Now, it's a little less critical in our culture today because women can so easily enter the workforce. But work with me. If I don't make enough money, her dad is going to be concerned. Well, the way that was handled back then was through the bride price. You weren't buying your bride. You were demonstrating solvency. You were demonstrating financial ability to sustain a family. You can part with this much money. And the reason that's not selling your daughter is because it's followed by the dowry. Yes, that was paid to the father of the bride, but the bride price comes at the engagement. But then when they get married, the bride's father gives an even larger sum. You see how both parties now have contributed to getting the couple off their feet? The bride price is less than the dowry. But that was not these girls' experience. Since Jacob didn't have a respectable bride price, he pretty much only had the clothes on his back and the staff he came with, Laban used his love for Rachel to enslave him. He exploited that love for 7 years, and then on the wedding night, he exploited the darkness and Jacob's inebriation to get seven more. And neither then nor 6 years ago when he finally paid off Rachel, He started serving for the flock. You know, that's when the contractual obligations were over. There was no dowry then. So Laban did sell his daughters. You don't do that with your daughters. Maybe a foreign slave, but not your daughters. So he treated them like foreigners. And all the money that he got from them is gone. So they conclude together agreeing, these women agreeing in verse 16, all the wealth that God has taken from our father belongs to us and to our children. Now, therefore, whatever God has said to you, do. So Jacob set his sons and his wives on camels. He drove away all his livestock and his property that he had gained, the livestock in his possession that he had acquired in Paddan Aram, to go to the land of Canaan to his father Isaac. Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole her father's household gods. And Jacob tricked Laban the Aramean by not telling him that he intended to flee. He fled with all that he had and arose and crossed the Euphrates and set his face toward the hill country of Gilead. So we don't know whether Laban happened to be away shearing his sheep when they had this conversation in the field, or whether after the conversation in the field they waited for that opportune time, but it came, and Laban is gone, so they take off secretly. And we're told out of the blue that Rachel stole her father's household gods. Now that's interesting, but we'll talk about it a bit, but I don't want it to make us miss something very interesting. That next verse, verse 20, here's how it reads in the Hebrew. And the ESV is a good translation. It captures the meaning of the Hebrew. But I want you to hear the idiom in the Hebrew, because it connects with what Rachel did, right? Rachel stole her father's household gods. And then it says, and Jacob stole the heart. That's the idiom for tricked. Jacob stole the heart of Laban the Aramean by not telling him that he was fleeing. So Rachel stole his household gods, and Jacob stole his heart. I'm not sure what to think of Rachel's actions here. I mean, I know she's wrong in what she does here, or I think she is, but that parallel makes you pause, doesn't it? We know that Jacob's concern that Laban won't let him go is pretty well founded. Or if we don't know that, we're about to find out. So is Jacob sneaking off sinful? Rachel is a little clearer cut case. She's probably taking justice into her own hands. You know, it wasn't enough for her that God had transferred all of her father's wealth to her. There were still those household gods. I don't know whether it was greed or retribution, a little act of vengeance, you know, I don't know. But I don't think it was at root idolatry. I could be wrong about that. We're going to see Rachel divest herself of these household gods before her death in chapter 35. But for now, let's just call her faith a little confused and immature. Her justification is complete, just like ours. But just like us, her sanctification is a work in progress. So in verse 22, Laban finds out that they left, and look what he does. When it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him for 7 days and followed close after him into the hill country of Gilead. So Laban wasn't going to let him go after all, right? And let's not forget who the original audience of this story is. The divine storyteller gave these things to Moses. And so our fathers, who had just come out of Egypt and were wandering in the wilderness, they're the first audience here. And Laban's pursuit, it's supposed to remind you of the Exodus. You know, when the girls say that God has taken, excuse me, when the girls say that God has taken what was their father's and given it to us. It's the same language that's used for the Israelites plundering the Egyptians as they leave Egypt. So this big bad slave master is in pursuit. But God intervenes, verse 24. But God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream by night and said to him, "Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad." Now, that language, that's exactly the words that Laban himself had used years ago when Abraham's servant came seeking Rebecca, and he had recounted all of the providential way that he had met Rebecca and how God had blessed all his travels. And Laban hears this and he says, "Well, this is from God. We can't say anything good or bad. I mean, if God's doing this, we're utterly powerless, right?" That's the idea. So God's basically telling Laban, "Watch your mouth. You are powerless here." And Laban overtook Jacob. Verse 25, Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country, and Laban with his kinsmen pitched tents in the hill country of Gilead. And Laban said to Jacob, "What have you done that you have tricked me and driven away my daughters like captives of the sword?" Wait, what? We know that Jacob asked his wives, don't we? If anyone, I mean, even though he had direction from God, appreciate this, even though Jacob had direction from God, he did not run roughshod over the agency or the desires of his wives. On the contrary, if anyone's threatened by the sword here, it's Laban's daughters and his son-in-law. It says, "Why did you flee secretly and trick me and did not tell me so that I might have sent you away with mirth and songs and tambourine and lyre?" No, tried that 6 years ago, you weren't having it. And why did you not permit me to kiss my sons and my daughters farewell? My sons and my daughters. The ones that he has jilted out of a dowry. The ones he sold. And the children that they bore. This guy is a piece of work. So Laban comes into this situation as this magnanimous grandfather who just wanted to take care of his grandchildren. Oh, and to celebrate their departure with a feast and a party. He comes in that way on the one hand, but look at the end of verse 28. He turns on a dime. His kindness and his magnanimity just vanish. "I could hurt you, you know. Now you have done foolishly. It is in my power to do you harm. But the God of your father spoke to me last night saying, 'Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad.' And now you've gone away because you longed greatly for your father's house." It has nothing to do with the fact that I'm a jerk. "But why did you steal my gods?" You know, now it's Jacob's turn to lay out his case. He was afraid. And since you've just admitted that you have the power and pretty clearly the desire to harm him, I think that fear was well-founded. Jacob answered and said to Laban, "Because I was afraid, for I thought that you would take your daughters from me by force." You've accused me of kidnapping, but you're the one threatening force. So far, Jacob's got the upper hand in this lawsuit. But then, verse 32. "Anyone with whom you find your gods shall not live. In the presence of our kinsmen, point out what I have that is yours and take it." Now, Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. Now, was this a rash vow? Probably. But you know, from Jacob's point of view, it's kind of justified. Years ago, when we were in the middle school, we had a hot summer like this, and we bought some fans. I bought some fans online. And the guys were loading up the van after worship, you know, and there were some fans sitting in the back of the cafeteria. And I think they even asked the custodial staff. They didn't know anything about them. So they assumed that those must have been the fans that I had bought. And they loaded him up. Well, I get a call in the middle of the week saying that, you know, we stole their fans. I know better. I assure them that that's just not the case. And they insist that they have video evidence. And I'm like, well, if you've got video of somebody stealing the fans, call the police. I didn't realize. Was that a rash vow? I don't know. From my point of view, it was true. I was confident of you guys' integrity. Oops. See, Jacob had turned over a new leaf. He wasn't a schemer. He wasn't a conniver. He wasn't a thief anymore. So he didn't expect a problem. But, you know, then again, death isn't exactly the appropriate punishment for theft. So, yeah, it might have been a bit rash. But remember who is with Jacob. Remember who's in control. So the text builds a bit of suspense in here, you know, as Laban searches for what we know is in Rachel's possession. He goes into Jacob's tent and into Leah's tent and into the tent of the two female servants, but he didn't find them. And he went out of Leah's tent and he enters into Rachel's. Oh, no, Rachel's going to die, right? No. Now, Rachel had taken the household gods and put them in the camel's saddle and sat on them. Laban felt all about the tent, but did not find them. And she said to her father, let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the way of women is upon me. So he searched, but he did not find the household gods. Now, you know, the Bible cannot help itself. If the Bible is ever referring to other gods, it can't help but make fun. It pokes fun almost every time. And so... Laban, appreciate this. First of all, Laban's gods can be stolen. It's a god napping. And then notice that Laban's gods are utterly defiled as they are covered with the blood of her uncleanness. Now, we're in on the secret, but Jacob isn't. So he gets really angry now, verse 36. Then Jacob became angry and berated Laban. Jacob said to Laban, what is my offense? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? For you felt through all my goods. What have you found of all your household goods? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen, that they may decide between the two of us. So at first, Jacob seems to be calling for judgment here, legal judgment. Laban came in with an accusation. The accusation came up empty, right? As will our accuser, by the way, Satan. It's not that there's nothing in our lives that he could point to, but that everything he could point to has been covered with blood. Jacob's defense rests since the prosecution can't make its case, but now he levels a countersuit. Verse 38. These 20 years I have been with you, your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried. I've not eaten the rams of your flocks. What was torn by wild beasts I didn't bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. From my hand you required it, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. There I was. By day the heat consumed me, and the cold by night, and my sleep fled from my eyes. So now we get to see the extent of Jacob's service. You know, he had told his wives that he had served their father with all his heart, and he did. You were blessed by my presence such that your sheep and your goats, they didn't miscarry. They wore their children. I never ate anything from your flock, which a hired shepherd would have been allowed to do occasionally. He never did that. If it was killed by a wild animal, normal shepherd would bring that evidence of that to the owner, and that would be that. No, he replaced it at his own cost. Why? Because Laban required it. Whether it was stolen by day or by night, there's a distinction in the law. He says, my service under you was utterly burdensome. There was no rest in it. That's why I say at first it seems like he's looking for a legal judgment here. Listen to how he ends. He says, God saw my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night. So it sort of looks like he's going for a legal judgment. But in the end, he sort of realizes he's gotten the only judgment that matters. God is on my side. God saw what you're doing and you rebuked me. So let's dispense with this, it's in my power to harm you business. It's like when Pilate says to Jesus, I can crucify you or set you free. And Jesus says, you really can't do anything except what my Father lets you do. Jacob is no longer afraid of Laban. Then Laban answered and said to Jacob, the daughters are my daughters. The children are my children. The flocks are my flocks. All that you see is mine. But what can I do this day for these daughters, these my daughters, or for their children they've borne? Come now, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me. So Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar, and Jacob said to his kinsmen, gather stones, and they took stones and made a heap. And they ate there by the heat. Laban called it Yeger Sahadutha, but Jacob called it Galid. They mean the same thing. They're just in different languages. Pile of witness. And the rest of our passage, it just recounts their parting. You know, they make this covenant and Laban leaves. Laban says, this heap is a witness between you and me today. Therefore, he named it Galid and Mizpah, for he said, the Lord watch between you and me and we, when we were out of each other's sight. If you oppress my daughters, if you take wives besides my daughters, although no one is with us, God is witness between us. And Laban said to Jacob, see this heap and this pillar which I have set between you and me. This heap is a witness and this pillar is a witness that I won't pass over this heap to you. You won't pass over this heap and this pillar to me to do harm. The God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us. So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac, and Jacob offered a sacrifice in the hill country and called his kinsmen to eat bread. They ate bread and spent the night in the hill country. Early in the morning, Laban arose, kissed his grandchildren and his daughters, and blessed them. Then Laban departed and returned home. So what are we supposed to glean from these events in Jacob's life? Why is this here? Well, you know, in terms of, by way of example, I think we can certainly see a transformation in Jacob that we ought to emulate. No longer is he striving for the best seat in the banquet. That was his nature, remember? He was always conniving. No longer. Now he's humble. If I'm going to succeed, God's going to have to do it. Jacob has learned to trust the Lord. And so do we find that he's also learned not to lie and cheat and steal, right? So God used all that suffering to make that happen, but now it's done. He's no longer a cheat, and yet he still gets cheated. I mean, his suffering changes. It's because it's now no longer justified, right? John 15, 19, Jesus tells us, if you were of the world would love you as its own, but because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. So God brings suffering into our lives. He really brings suffering into all of our lives, and he does it for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it is to correct us. But you know, God's purposes in your life are not merely for your personal comfort. He may make you comfortable for a while, and if that's the case, praise him for it. But God he's not just relieving us of suffering in this age. He's given us a path of eternal joy, even in the midst of our suffering. Remember how the apostles sang hymns in their jail cells on the night before their execution? That's what the gospel does for us. Sometimes, as in the case of the first 14 years in Padan Aram, sometimes our suffering is because we need to learn something, and it's chastisement. But you know, in the next six, the repentant man, and so the righteous man, Jacob, still suffers under Laban's hand. And God let him stay there and endure it for 6 years. So now we kind of get to see Jacob deal with a different kind of suffering, completely unjustified malice, deceit, and treachery. Jacob has been super kind, super generous, and this is how his kindness is repaid. Well, maybe that's where you find yourself. You know, sometimes we're being trained by suffering that makes sense to us. But sometimes we're suffering and we just can't make sense of it. But what we can absolutely count on is that in whatever way and for whichever reason we're suffering, God is with us in it. And that even the worst things that we face redound to our good because they redound to God's glory. God has tied His good, your good, to His glory. So He can be absolutely trusted in all circumstances. And you know, even when we're guilty, deserve death, like Rachel, as when, you know, by Jacob's own pronouncement, Rachel's life comes under threat. You know, even when we're guilty and don't know it, and we so often are. In fact, the Bible tells us that our best, the best you ever do, is as filthy rags before Him. And yet, no weapon that is fashioned against you will succeed. And you shall refute every tongue that arises against you in judgment. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord, and their vindication is from me, declares the Lord. That's the application. Rejoice. Even if you're suffering, flagrant and blatant, Oh, I created a word there, didn't I? Flagrant and blatant injustice, know that God is with you in it. It's all going to work out for you in the end. That's His promise. And He's one you can trust. Jacob saw it. He saw how God had overcome Laban's efforts to impoverish him. And we see it all the more clearly now with the evidence that God has provided of His covenant faithfulness, of His trustworthiness. He didn't withhold His only Son from us, but gave Him up for us while we were enemies. You know, after the supper, we're going to enjoy some special music emphasizing this very point. It's a song that's based more on Noah than it is on Jacob, but the point's the same. God can be trusted. He can be trusted absolutely. And even when it seems ridiculous, He can be trusted. God is with you, brother or sister, just as He was with Jacob so that Laban couldn't hurt him, so He is with you, and no weapon that is fashioned against you will stand. That doesn't mean there won't be trials or suffering. It simply means that God knows the suffering you are facing. He is using it for your glory. He will give you the strength to endure it. And He will vindicate you in the end because He has covered your sin. So what can we do but trust Him, obey Him, and really sing His praises to all who will listen to us? Will you pray with me? Oh, Heavenly Father, produce in us the kind of confidence and hope that our father Jacob had. Transform us even as You transformed him. Give us such humility. Teach us to lean on You such that far from scheming and conniving, that we would even disadvantage ourselves, that any blessing we receive must come from You. knowing that you will indeed lift us up. Teach us, Lord, to take the lower seat in the banquet. Give us the endurance and the integrity to serve you well, as our father Jacob did, even when such service is onerous or unjust. Teach us to rejoice in all circumstances and to wait for you. For Jesus' sake, we ask it.